Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about an area which goes under the sort of general title of microfluidics. But we're going to be talking to Professor Suichi Takayama from the University of Michigan, and we're going to learn quite a lot about this, the uses of this new technology, all the way from getting new materials, perhaps, new devices, and even helping in reproduction. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Okay, now before Shu, I'm going to call you Shu from now on.
Yeah.
Before we get into microfluidics and its applications and the principles behind it, tell us a little bit about Shu. How did you become a scientist? What were those formative years where you suddenly realized, hey, there's a career out there, there's a fascination I have? How did that go for you?
Well, if I reflect back, I think I did have some inclination towards fluidics or fluid flowing. You know, I remember when I was still in elementary school playing in the sandbox, and I liked making little grooved mountains and flow water down that.
Oh.
Or playing with clay.
Yes.
And I liked making clay plumbing systems with little showers and bathtubs and toilets.
You actually made a toilet of clay?
So yeah. It's,
what happened when you flushed it?
Yeah, so the idea is that you'd make little canals and containers and lids and things, and then you make a mess on the kitchen table by dumping water on the top and see where it flows. Now that I think about it, I did like doing those things.
Oh, that's remarkable. Did you do this at the coast also sometimes? I used to build sandcastles on the coast in England.
No, it was not on the coast. It was just in a friend's sandbox.
And your parents then realized he was an engineer in the budding.
I'm not sure, because I also remember later on in college, I did take one class in fluid mechanics, and I learned about water draining through a pipe, and I had absolutely no interest about the fluidics in that particular class. So I've gone back and forth.
Okay. Whereabouts did you go to university? Where did you study?
University of Tokyo.
And for all of your degrees, or how did it go from your first degree?
University of Tokyo up until my master's degree. And then I did my PhD at the Scripps Research Institute in Organic Synthetic Chemistry.
I didn't realize that you were started out as a synthetic fellow.
Right. So in high school, I had a great chemistry teacher that got me interested in organic chemistry. And then in college, I had an interesting teacher also that taught about how insect pheromones had right and left-hand molecules and how you could get bugs to come and go and things. And so that got me excited about organic chemistry. And that's what I did for my PhD.
That's interesting. Tell us then now, we've got a little bit of a background, interesting beginning. Microfluidics as a young boy, organic chemistry as a young student, and now microfluidics. Tell us, what does it mean, microfluidics?
It's just manipulation of small volumes of fluid in interesting ways, useful ways. On a practical level, if you shrink a container in linear dimensions 10 times, the volume of liquid you have to use to fill that container decreases by 1,000 times. And so by shrinking and being able to do tests or reactions in a 10 times smaller dimension container, you can save reagent costs 1,000 times. If you shrink linear dimensions 100 times, you save 1,000,000 times. So being able to manipulate small amounts of liquid, that can be cost-saving. So that's one reason we like to manipulate small volumes of liquid. The other things that happen is that you can get unexpected things happening at the small scale, like a phenomena called laminar flow, where in the macroscopic world that we live in, we expect flowing water to turbulently mix with each other. That's why when we wash our hands with hot and cold water, we get warm water to wash our hands. So we expect aqueous solutions, water, to mix relatively well when we flow it through a pipe. But if you shrink your pipe, you actually get a phenomenon called laminar flow, where the fluid flows in a much more orderly manner, so you get less turbulent mixing. So the way you can imagine this is that if there was a little ant or a bug that wanted to wash its hand, and the bug had a micro faucet, it would turn on the hot water and cold water, and instead of getting warm water to wash its little hands with, it would get hot water on one hand and cold water on the other hand because the water is not mixing. So that, those are the types of things we work with in microfluidics.
I mean, that's a sort of great image. But tell us, what sizes are we talking about? I haven't studied ants recently, but I mean, how big are the two pipes, if you like, that are conjoining, one with a hot, one with a cold? How small do you have to get before the flow from one doesn't mix with the other?
So typically we work with microchannels that are about the width of your hair. So that's in actual dimensions, that's on the order of tens of micrometers. That's a very common dimension for microchannels.
So when was this first discovered? I mean, it's an interesting phenomenon. When was it first clear that laminar flow could be created in this fashion? Some history here.
Oh, gee. I think it's actually a really long time ago. So most of the fluid mechanics people would tell me, oh, what you're doing is so well known and so mathematically simple and clear, it's boring.
Don't you just hate those people? Right.
So I think it's been known for a long time. It's just that the ability to microfabricate these small pipes in a user-defined manner and then coming up with ways to use the phenomena, I think that's what's more new rather than identification of the phenomena.
So, I mean, in a sense then, you're saying that perhaps this was a theoretical understanding, but mankind didn't have the capacity to make such small channels.
At least not as conveniently.
Well, how do you make these small channels? I mean, that must be a big challenge.
There are different ways to make these channels. In our case, we kind of do it like cooking. So you can obtain a master mold of the features that you want, and that can use any high-tech method like lasers or lights or any other method. But we usually do that just once. And then after that, it's like baking a cake. We take a pre-polymer, a polymer goo, pour it over this microfeature, just like you'd pour batter dough into a cake pan. And we heat it typically to about 60 degrees, wait a few hours, and we take it out. The polymer has hardened around these microchannel features. When we carefully detach this rubber polymer cake out of the pan, we have very nice fine features at the bottom. And if we place this rubber stamp, basically, that you end up with, if you place that on a flat surface, now you have microchannels.
Okay, so we're talking channels and not pipes, which makes it a lot easier.
Most of these are. I don't know what you mean in the difference between channels and pipes. But
well, a pipe is sort of completely encompassing the fluid, whereas a channel is like a canal.
Oh, I see. After the baking, you get channels with one side open, but then we place it on a flat surface so that it is a pipe. So it is all enclosed in most cases.
Okay, but it's not circular now. It's got a flat side and then an arched side.
That's right. So most of our channels are rectangular.
So now tell us then, you've got this technology, and I'm sure you weren't the first one to devise it. But what are the sort of thoughts that you had when you started your career about what you were going to do with these new micro channels? What was the idea behind your entry into the research area?
So it was a c- kind of an accident. So my motivation for generally getting into the microtechnology field was to test drugs on cells. So during my PhD, I did work on synthesizing enzyme inhibitors, so potential drugs. So what I found out was I would spend months and years synthesizing a chemical, and then someone else would sprinkle it on cells and tell me that I did a bad job or good. And that seemed to be very not quite satisfying for me. And what really got me interested or worried about this was that sometimes you give the same molecule to one biological tester versus another, and they would tell you different things. Why, if the molecule is the same, would one person tell me it works and the other that it doesn't work?
But these are on different cells, though, right?
These are on different cells, or actually it could be on the same cells under different culture conditions. For example, with and without flow, or with and without something different.
Right.
And so this got me interested in being able to develop assays, cell-based assays, where I could control the cell environment so that maybe the molecules I spend so long synthesizing, I could really test them in the way I feel they should be tested until it's really been rigorously analyzed.
So that
was my initial motivation.
I mean, but that's interesting because one tends to think naively, at least this is the way Keith Pannell thinks, that a cell is a cell, all right, and you expose that to some potential antibiotic or some pharmaceutical material, and the chemistry and the biology would follow from there. And what you're suggesting, or you're stating, is that the physical nature of the experiment plays a key role. If, for example, the cells are all bottled up into a biofilm, or if they're under a fast flow of antibiotic or pharmaceutical material. So am I getting that correct?
That's right. So just like the same person can feel different in Disneyland versus in a jail cell, a cell behaves...
Speaking as a parent that's been to both, they're both pretty damn boring.
Okay, you have to think of something more exciting for you then. So the same cell can behave and respond very differently depending on the environment it's exposed to or cultured under. So much of our microfluidic technology tries to recreate for cells the environment that they might experience in the body.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest today is Suichi Takayama from the University of Michigan, an expert, as you've just heard, in microfluidics. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Scientists had believed for a century that the human fetus is sterile and only becomes infected with bacteria during and after birth. Only in recent years did we find out that's not true.
I love it when we scientists are flat out wrong, because it upholds the first rule in science, to question even things we take for granted. It was in 2010 when a researcher tested the first stool samples of newborns right after birth to find a diversity of bacteria there.
Since then, the focus has been how and from where the mother passes the bacteria onto her fetus. And do the microbes include potentially harmful specimens or beneficial ones known as our microbiome, which live in and on us to keep us healthy?
When researchers sampled the microbiome of the vagina, the samples didn't match ones found in newborns. Instead, a new study looked at the placenta, which is the tissue that provides nutrients to the fetus.
They collected 320 placentas taken immediately after birth and extracted DNA from each to sequence for microbial genomes. For the first time, they learned the placenta harbors microbes.
Interestingly, they most closely resemble the microbiome of the mother's mouth. Researchers believe the microbes break free when a mother brushes her teeth, enters her bloodstream, then gets carried to the placenta.
It would make sense, since there's an established connection between gum disease and preterm births. Indeed, the microbes in the placentas of preterm babies differed from full-term ones.
This study is part of the U.S. Microbiome Project, which helps us understand the complex relationship between humans and the communities of bacteria, fungi, and viruses that live in and on us.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Suichi Takayama from the University of Michigan, and we're talking about microfluidics. We're talking about the ability to have these very, very tiny channels that can transport fluids about the width of a hair, and that they can do many, many interesting technological things. And one was this evaluation of antibiotics or pharmaceutical materials on cells. So, Shu, going back to that interest you have, what have you learned? What are some of the big surprises that you and your group have learned by using this technology on, say, drug action in general?
So we have learned that depending on the exact environment, the cells will behave differently. And if you think about the body, we have a lot of little tubes and ducts and channels inside, like blood vessels, tear ducts, reproductive tracts. We found that, yes, depending on how you flow fluid or even air or a combination of fluid and air, the cells will behave very differently.
That implies that clever cells would find little places to hide in the body so that the drug regime would be ineffective. That's rather worrying.
So very important result, yes.
And so how do you get around that?
So we try to recreate what goes on in the body. So, for example, oftentimes cell-based tests are currently performed in the bottom of microwells, which are flat and hard. Our bodies are not flat and hard. The tissues are kind of nice and soft and three-dimensional. So we've made some micro devices where we can grow cells in nice little balls of cells, where the cells are more three-dimensional, for example. Or we've made devices for reproduction, where pre-implantation embryos are gently rocked and nurtured in fluid flow, a little bit more similar to how they might be in the mother's body rather than in a hard, static dish.
And the implication is that you're getting positive results from that?
And so, for example, embryos grown under these microfluid conditions will develop faster and better and lead to better pregnancy rates.
I mean, and tell us what better means. Is this a 50-fold increase or a 5%? So, what are we talking?
It's true. So in mice, we had about a 20% increase in pregnancy rates. The human statistics is a little bit more complicated. So we don't have pregnancy rate statistics, but the embryo development seems to be better in human as well, which we believe might translate to enhanced pregnancy rates in humans as well.
Now, let's go back then to the pharmaceutical aspect. If you've got a particular cancer cell or whatever cells you're evaluating, and you're treating this with some new drug, does that same activity of a rocking device or a more comfortable cell well, does that also have an impact on the efficacy of the drug?
So, for example, we've made microchannel-based models of cancer metastasis. We've tested some drugs that inhibit certain receptor chemoattractant interactions and illustrated that the cells that this inhibitor works on, at least for the intravascular step of cancer cells attaching to the wall of the blood vessel, we used to, at least we initially, when we started out, thought the inhibitors would work by inhibiting the cancer cell receptors, but then we found out that it's actually the blood vessel wall cell where the inhibitor worked better, for example.
So you're not inhibiting something on the cell itself, but the cell's ability to locate itself somewhere in the body.
So we inhibit cells, but it wasn't the direct inhibition of the cancer cell receptors that was doing the trick. It was actually inhibiting similar receptors on the blood vessel wall cells.
Right.
So understanding where the action was.
So illustrating that cancer cells need to be in a very comfortable place. And if you make that place less comfortable or block it, then you're inhibiting the metastasis.
Yeah, so to understand how cancer cells might be metastasizing in the bloodstream, it's very important that you have a flowing system and that you have both cancer cells and endothelial cells under physiological conditions as much as possible.
This is very interesting. Now, remember, you and I have met once before, and I remember talking to you about these experiments with motility how would I put it, viability of sperm.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you run through and give that sort of experimental setup to the audience, because I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, so one day I was talking with my in vitro fertilization clinical doctor collaborator, and he said, "Shu, yesterday, or at least a few days ago, I spent hours sifting through a patient's sperm sample, trying to find the few good sperm that I could inject into an egg to create a fertilized egg. So I said, "Gary, what is your criteria for selecting a good sperm and separating from a bad one?" And he said, "Well, the good sperm are strong and good-looking, meaning that they have good motility, swimming capabilities, and they have a good morphology." And so we thought about this for a while and said, "Well, if motility and swimming capability is so important, why don't we try and see if the laminar flow phenomena could be used to race our sperm, and they will be given 20 seconds to prove themselves, and we will select the good swimmers and separate out the bad ones." So I had a great graduate student, Brenda, who was good with microfluidics, and she made a coin-sized device that was really simply driven by gravity in terms of fluid flow. She had a clever scheme of creating nice laminar flows driven by gravity, and we put sperm in one of the channels, had a blank stream flowing next to the sperm, and the good sperm would swim it across into the other stream. And then after 20 seconds, we had an exit for the good sperm and another exit for the bad one. And we were able to purify sperm very gently and efficiently, especially for difficult samples where there weren't very many good sperm.
And the result, I gather, was that the good sperm did a better job in fertilizing eggs?
So we don't have as strong a statistic for that. We definitely know that the sperm are better swimmers and they have better morphology. We do have some indications that we think it's producing better embryos with and less DNA damage. That the statistics is a little weak, but yes, that's the implication.
That's interesting. And how long do you have to keep performing these experiments before you come up with good statistical data to say, hey, this is a generalized technology that we could use?
So the thing is, only humans get bad sperm. So this is a test that we really can't do on mouse sperm, which would give great statistics and easy experiments, because mouse sperm are all good.
Hang on a minute. I want to have you explain why it is that humans only, amongst the animals that you've investigated, have bad sperm.
Yeah.
I feel affronted.
I'm not sure either, but I've chatted with this a little bit with Gary, and he thinks maybe it's because we wear pants or we kind of don't cool the important places enough or something. I'm not exactly sure. But apparently humans are one of the worst sperm animals out there. And so meaningful sperm sorting experiments you have to do with humans. And then humans, you don't have transgenic or the well-bred, genetically characterized human that you can deal with. So we don't have as good statistics and figures for how much better the sorted sperm are.
But at the end, I presume that this is going to be tried. I mean, actually, in vivo, people are going to use these high swimming sperm.
Yes, so there actually are human babies born from microfluidic cultured embryos as well as microfluidic cultured sperm. And we expect them to be stronger and better looking, but we just don't have the statistics for that.
Let's go back to the thought that your colleague Gary mentioned, that it's to do with the temperature of the susceptible parts of the male body that are to do with this. Is there any difference between, for example, people who live in Lapland? I mean, has that sort of data out there?
I think there are reports of quality of sperm over the years or something like that. And I think some people do report or say that it might be going down.
Well, sperm count, I remember reading and doing a radio show on that.
Uh-huh.
But sperm count's not quite the same as what I might call the virility of the sperm, right?
I think there may be relationship. So I think there's a lot of environmental behavioral things that might be contributing to decline of sperm number as well as the quality.
Well, this is all very fascinating, Shu. It's a wonderful sort of offspring from a well-known phenomena that you're now being able to take advantage of. And you've taken advantage of it, as you alluded to earlier, by having startup companies. What are some of the activities in those companies?
So the technologies that are most active right now, we have a 3D cell culture platform technology that's been licensed to a local startup, and it's sold around the world. It's called a Perfecta hanging drop plate from a company called 3D Biomatrix, and this is for high-throughput 3D cell culture used for cancer drug screening, toxicology screening, and so forth.
What do you mean by 3D cell culture?
So instead of the typical cell culture of having the cells attach and growing at the bottom of a microwell on a flat plastic, hard plastic, where the cells will spread out and become really thin like paper. Instead, we have little balls of cells that are a few hundred micrometers in diameter. And the same drugs can have completely different effects on the same cells, just depending on whether they're in so-called 2D cultures at the bottom of a well or in 3D cultures. So that's one technology that's active.
I want to interject right at the end here because I want to go back to that very first experiment you did on the kitchen table with sand and water and making a mess. Obviously, your parents, are they still alive?
Yes.
So do they know what you're doing, and are you keeping them abreast, and are they marveling at the development of this little child that was playing with water and sand into this technology that you've developed?
I don't think they remember me playing with those things. I'm not sure they remember those things at all. But, they do try to encourage me and have interest in what I'm doing and try to save newspaper clippings of interesting scientific developments and things like that. So they're very supportive.
Well, that's lovely. And finally, do you have children following in your footsteps with sand and water on the kitchen table?
I have a son starting engineering at Michigan this fall, but he seems to be more in computers.
As they all are. Shu Takayama, University of Michigan, microfluidics expert, developer of new technologies. It's been a lot of fun having you here on Science Studio. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank, as usual, Norma Martinez for putting the program together, and you, the listener, for being there and listening. And we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. The second annual clinical simulation conference of West Texas takes place in El Paso next weekend. The conference examines current topics in clinical competency in medical training and practice. There will be hands-on practice with state-of-the-art clinical simulators. Continuing education credits will be available. Read more under the calendar at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from Kindred Hospital.